Well, we're going to continue on with our history lesson from that we started last week. And we see this prophecy, these prophecies that were given to Daniel all came true in amazing detail. And these historical facts are interesting to us and stimulates our thinking, but we want to also remember the real reasons that God gave this prophecy. And there are a number of them, and I just cited a few last week that I think are important. First of all, they reveal a God who is sovereign. It shows that he alone is worthy of our praise. He is almighty, and he knows the end from the beginning, and these prophecies show us that. Secondly, they reveal a covenant-keeping God. He's faithful, and he does not abandon his people. His mercy endures forever. They're going to go through some tough times, and that's part of what's happening here is that they're getting prepared for that, but he's not abandoning them. And then thirdly, they give Daniel and the Jews encouragement for the present and preparation for the future. There are difficult days ahead of them. They have been allowed to return to Jerusalem, but they're still not free. They will still be subject to the Persians and then the Greeks, followed by the Seleucids and Ptolemies and eventually the Romans. So God didn't want them to be caught unaware of what was coming. And he wanted to give them some encouragement that they could use to make it through those days. Well, tonight I thought we'd do something a little bit different. I know that things came at you pretty hot and heavy last time, and you may have felt like you were kind of drinking through a fire hose. So I want to spend a little more time on our review this week. And the way I'd like to do it is I'd like to take some time and go verse by verse, and we'll read the verse, then we'll just recap how that came about in history. So hopefully this bit of extra review will be of some value to kind of pull together what we talked about last week. So at the end of chapter 10, we saw that there was an angel had been speaking to Daniel, and the angel told him that he had been delayed because he was in a battle with the prince of Persia. So we got a glimpse into the battles that take place there. And then last week we saw these series of prophetic, of these prophecies about the conflicts that are coming, dealing with the Persians and the Greeks, then after the breakup of Alexander's kingdom, his four generals. So we're going to try to do a little bit deeper review, and hopefully this will help to tie up and make some sense of all that we talked about last week. So if we begin at verse 2, we'll just kind of run through these. So verse 2 says, "And now I will show you the truth. Behold, three more kings shall arise in Persia, and a fourth shall be far richer than all of them. And when he has become strong through his riches, he shall stir up all against the kingdom of Greece." And so what happened here was that we saw that after Cyrus, there were three other kings. It was Cambyses, Bardia, and Darius the Great. They were next in line after Cyrus, who was there at Daniel's time. And it said, and then a fourth is going to arise. Well, that fourth is Xerxes, and he was very wealthy. He did a lot of conquests and acquired a lot of wealth from those conquests. He allied with Persia, with Carthage, and some of the Greek city-states, but in the end, his large army was defeated, and he withdrew. And then we saw this chart, which just reviewed some of the kings. So after Cyrus, we know from history there was Cambyses and Bardia and Darius and Xerxes and Artaxerxes. Now Xerxes, the one, was also Ahasuerus. This is the fellow who was the emperor or the king during the time of Esther. So he's the one that brought Esther into the court. And we reviewed the Bible verses that related to each of those kings. Then verse 3 talks about, then a mighty king shall arise who shall rule with great dominion and do as he wills. And of course, this is directly prophesying the coming of Alexander the Great. So Alexander came to power in Greece, and he rapidly conquered the Persian Empire and beyond. And as it says here, he pretty much did as he willed. Then it says, I think this is actually verse 4. I marked it verse 3, but it should be verse 4. Then a mighty king shall arise. That's the same, isn't it? Okay. I have that slide in there twice. All right, verse 4. And as soon as he has arisen, his kingdom shall be broken and divided toward the four winds of heaven. So this is a reference to the fact that Alexander died young. He died at age 32. So his kingdom, he rose quickly. He conquered the Persian Empire and beyond in 12 years. But then he died. And when he died, he had one legitimate son who was very young. In fact, the son was not yet born. The son was born after his death. And then he had another illegitimate son who was a few years older, but both of those were killed by the enemy. So he had no heir. So the phrase in there, not to his posterity, that's what that's talking about. Nor according to the authority with which he ruled. So there was not an Alexander dynasty, if you will, to pass it on to. So what happened was his four generals divvied up the kingdom. And so that's the reference there to the four winds of heaven. And they divided up the kingdom into those four pieces that we've talked about. And this map shows that. So the gray here went to the general Seleucus and became known as the Seleucid Empire. The purple down to the south went to Ptolemy, primarily Egypt, but also beyond that. And then up in the green was his general Cassander, who was in Macedonia and part of Greece. And then the general Lysimachus there in yellow, he took Thrace and parts to the north of Thrace. That orange area of Antigonus, that was just briefly held by Antigonus, and Seleucus came and, with the aid of Ptolemy, took over that, and that became a part of the Seleucid Empire. Well, then we came to verse 5, and verse 5 says, "Then the king of the south shall be strong, but one of his princes shall be stronger than he and shall rule, and his authority shall be great authority." So this is a reference to the first general, Ptolemy, who became the king of the south, again, primarily based in Egypt, and the general Seleucus, who was the king of the north. And again, they're called the north and the south because they're north and south of Israel. It's all given in relation to Israel because this is about Israel and about the Jews. Now, initially, Ptolemy from Egypt helped Seleucus to take over that one area that Antigonus was in. And in time, Seleucus became greater in power. So from here on now, the vision is going to focus on this king of the north and the king of the south because they're the ones that are going to have an impact on the Jews. The other two guys up in Greece and Thrace, they have an effect on world history and of that area, but they're not going to affect the Jews, so the vision's not going to address those anymore. We also said that during this time, Greek language and culture were ingrained in the region during the reigns of these empires, and so it wasn't Alexander so much. He set the stage. He conquered the territory, but then as his generals took over, they were the ones that really indoctrinated the areas with the Greek culture and language. I think we mentioned last week that down in Egypt, none of the Ptolemies for almost 300 years, none of them spoke Greek. Spoke Egyptian. They all spoke Greek. So was the impact of the Greek language throughout that part of the world. And as we said, that spread of language and culture sets the stage for the coming of Christ, and also the rapid spread of the gospel. That common Greek language aided in the gospel being spread rapidly. So again, a lot of history pressed into this chapter. We're seeing God's hand at work and that he's sovereign over history. And then just as a reminder, here were the kings we saw. The kings in the south all bore the name Ptolemy, and then they had another name tacked onto the end. In some cases, it was an expression of their pride in themselves, like Epiphanes, or sometimes, like Ptolemy III, the Euergetes, that was a title bestowed on him. It means benefactor. He did some good things for the Egyptian people. We'll review that in a minute. But they were given that name. Then over the north, they were either Seleucus or Antiochus, and they also had another name that sometimes they adopted for themselves or was given to them, and they kind of followed that line. Now, there are other kings in each of the dynasties beyond that, but these are the ones that are covered here in Daniel, and these are the ones that are important because they really are setting up the stage for that last guy there, that Antiochus Epiphanes. And we're going to talk about him next week. He was a great enemy of the Jews. He did great evil. Sometimes he's referred to as the Antichrist of the Old Testament. And he certainly is a type of the coming Antichrist, and we'll begin to see that unravel next week. Well, then when we've talked about verse 6, after some years they shall make an alliance, and the daughter of the king of the south shall come to the king of the north to make an agreement, but she shall not retain the strength of her arm, and he and his arm shall not endure, but she shall be given up, and her attendants who fathered her, and he who supported her in those times. Well, this is talking about the time when the Egyptian king Ptolemy Philadelphus gave his daughter Bernice to Antiochus Theos to be a wife. So he thought, we're going to form an alliance with Seleucus, with the Syrians, and so what better way to do that than to marry them off? So his daughter Bernice went there and became his wife. The only problem was Antiochus was already married, so he had to agree to put away his wife, Laodicea, and her children, and the marriage didn't last. Ptolemy died.
Well, put away his wife, you mean kill her?
No. He just removed her from the court, and so he didn't officially divorce her, but he just kind of sent her away. Yeah. And then we saw this portrayal. So we had Ptolemy and Antiochus. They were the kings of the Ptolemaic and the Seleucid empires. And Ptolemy's daughter, Berenice, he thought, oh, what a great idea. I'll marry her off to Antiochus. But as we said, the problem was Antiochus already had a wife. And oh, by the way, they had 5 kids. So that was a problem. But Antiochus did turn away Laodicea and the 5 kids, and he married Berenice. So normal way that they would do alliances back at that time through marriage. So it sounded good to begin with, like a good idea, but there were these complications that we talked about with the wife and the kids. So the marriage did have those conditions, that he would put her away and that he would marry Berenice, and only the children through Berenice would be in the royal line. So he was going to exclude the other children from the royal line. Well, a couple of years after that, Ptolemy dies. So he's no longer around to see this is all happening the right way. Things go south. Laodicea is restored into the court. She kills Antiochus. They kill Berenice and her kids, so everybody dies. It was a mess. Then verse 7 said, and from a branch from her roots, one shall arise in his place. He shall come against the army and enter the fortress of the king of the north, and he shall deal with them and shall prevail. And so this is referring to the fact that after Berenice was killed, when she went to marry Antiochus, her brother, Ptolemy III, became the king when his father died. Well, he's going to go avenge the death of his sister. And the only problem is his sister has already died. So he can't go back and just, there's nothing he can do to restore her. She's dead. But what he does do is he goes on this tirade against the territories. And so he captures Syria and Cilicia and parts of Mesopotamia as far as the Tigris River. So that's how he goes about getting revenge for his sister's death. As a result of that, he became very wealthy. He acquired a lot of spoil or booty along the way that he took into his storehouses. Part of what he found along the way were some Egyptian idols that had been removed from Egypt hundreds of years before. So he brings these idols back, and the Egyptian people love him for that because he's restored their idols to him. And so they give him the name Euergetes, meaning benefactor. So they were impressed by that. Well, then here's a map to show us some of the area. Let me magnify one part of this here. So the kingdom of Ptolemy is all that yellow down there in Egypt and North Africa. over to Cyrene, and then down south toward Ethiopia. But also, it extended up here into this green area. So at the time of the map, the green area is showing that's the area that the Seleucids have recaptured. But at the time we're talking about right now, it was owned by Egypt. So they extended their realm up into the borders of Syria, and that was Ptolemy III getting revenge for his sister being killed. Well, then in verse 8 we read, he shall also carry off to Egypt their gods with their metal images and their precious vessels of silver and gold, and for some years he shall refrain from attacking the king of the north. Well, again, Ptolemy Euergetes returned home and had a time of just kind of sitting at home for a little while. And then verse 9 said, then the latter shall come into the realm of the king of the south, but shall return to his own land. So the next king in the Seleucid dynasty, Seleucus II, decided to invade Egypt. So now we're down to like 240 BC when this is happening. But he was forced to retreat because he was beaten soundly in that attempt. And then shortly after that, he falls from his horse and dies. Verse 10 said, his sons shall wage war and assemble a multitude of great forces, which shall keep coming and overflow and pass through, and again shall carry the war as far as his fortress. Well, this is talking about the sons of Seleucus II. They waged war. That's a combination of war and warfare. They were waging war in Egypt. And then Seleucus the Third didn't last too long. His brother Antiochus took the throne. He passed through the beautiful land. And then he went down to Egypt, and he made an initial attack on Egypt. He was not successful, but then a second time he was. So it says he would pass through, meaning he would pass through the beautiful land on his way to attack Egypt. And he fought up to the very fortress, which was meaning Ptolemy's fortress at Gaza. And there's a picture of Antiochus III, or Antiochus the Great. He reigned for like 37 years, and we're going to be talking about him more tonight. And then we read in verse 11, then the king of the south, moved with rage, shall come out and fight against the king of the north, and he shall raise a great multitude, but it shall be given into his hand. So this is a reference to Antiochus III attacking another Ptolemy, Ptolemy IV. Ptolemy IV was outraged by Antiochus and his attacks, and so he fights back against him, and in that fight, Antiochus' army, which was a large army, is pretty much wiped out. So the phrase, it shall not be given into his hand. And then finally, last week we read verse 12, and when the multitude is taken away, his heart shall be exalted, and he shall cast down tens of thousands, but he shall not prevail. And this is a reference to the character, if you will, of Ptolemy IV. After his victory, he was very proud of himself, but he became lazy and extravagant, recklessly so. He was indulging every desire. He had a military advantage at that time, but he did not pursue it. He laid back and relaxed. So that caused him to lose favor with his own people because he wasn't aggressive and pushing forward. And so senior members of his court killed him. So that's a little more extensive review than we usually do, but hopefully that helped to kind of reinforce some of what we talked about last week, and hopefully that was helpful. Well, let's take a look at the next set of verses, beginning in verse 13. We'll just go through verse 20 tonight because there's kind of a break at that point and a change in subject. So I'll read verses 13 to 20, and again, just if you want to jot down any important words to get an overview of our passage. For the king of the north shall again raise a multitude, greater than the first. And after some years, he shall come on with a great army and abundant supplies. In those times, many shall rise against the king of the south, and the violent among your own people shall lift themselves up in order to fulfill the vision, but they shall fail. Then the king of the north shall come and throw up siege works and take a well-fortified city, and the forces of the south shall not stand, or even his best troops, for there shall be no strength to stand. But he who comes against him shall do as he wills, and none shall stand before him. And he shall stand in the glorious land with destruction in his hand. He shall set his face to come with the strength of his whole kingdom, and he shall bring terms of an agreement and perform them. He shall give him the daughter of women to destroy the kingdom, but it shall not stand or be to his advantage. Afterward, he shall turn his face to the coastlands and shall capture many of them. But a commander shall put an end to his insolence. Indeed, he shall turn his insolence back upon him. Then he shall turn his face back toward the fortresses of his own land, but he shall stumble and fall and shall not be found. Then shall arise in his place one who shall send an exactor of tribute for the glory of the kingdom. But within a few days he shall be broken, neither in anger nor in battle. Okay, so what jumped out at you there is important words.
Face.
Turning his face.
Setting his face.
Yeah.
A despicable person will arise.
Shall not stand. And, of course, lots of fighting. So, okay, great, thanks. Well, in these verses, the prophecy continues. God prophesies events that indicate that the Seleucids, or Syria, as we sometimes refer to it, will gain ascendancy over Egypt. And in so doing, they'll gain control of the Holy Land, which in turn sets the stage for the persecutions in Israel brought about by this despicable Syrian king, Antiochus Epiphanes, that we'll get into more next week. The Seleucids were able to take advantage of the laziness, indulgence, and extravagance of Ptolemy IV down in Egypt. This is described in verse 13. We read about a similar problem that King Uzziah had when he became puffed up. That's in 2 Chronicles 26, 15, and 16.
Therefore the Lord was angry with Amaziah and sent to him a prophet who said to him, "Why have you sought the gods of the people who did not deliver their own people from your hand?" But as he was speaking, the king said to him, "Have we made you a royal counselor? Stop. Why should you be struck down?" So the prophet stopped but said, "I know that God has determined to destroy you because you have done this and have not listened to my counsel."
So Uzziah, similar problems there of pride and thinking he knew more than God. And then finally, just kind of a general warning about this, Proverbs 16:18.
Right goes before destruction, and the Holy Spirit before fall.
So we see that happen in the life of Ptolemy, and it had an impact on his people. He's the king, and so it impacts the rest of the nation as well. Well, Antiochus the Great began to build up his army, as it says here, and he's building them, focusing more in the north after his battles with Ptolemy, where he lost almost everything. So he regroups, he turns away from Egypt for his conquest, and he's going to go and attack in the north and the east to expand his kingdom. Over the next 15 years, his army grew greater than it had ever been, and he was able to conquer the Parthians and other eastern peoples in the region. After the death of Ptolemy IV, who was also called Philopater, his young son, Ptolemy V Epiphanes, became king. Now, the boy was only about 5 or 6 years old when he became king. So Antiochus the Great took advantage of that situation in Egypt to regain territory that had previously been taken by the Egyptians. We saw how they went up along the coast there in Israel. Verses 14 to 17 describe how Antiochus the Great's attention turned once again to Egypt and the king of the south. Antiochus the Great continued his fight against Egypt in 199 and 198 BC. And verse 14 speaks of many rising up against the king of the south. Well, this includes Philip V of Macedon. Egypt still held some territory in the north toward Israel, but also in the Aegean Sea. They held some islands there, and also up into Turkey. And Philip was interested in those areas because he, being in Macedon, he's close to the Aegean Sea. So that piques his interest. And so he and Antiochus get together. They're both interested in this, in some of these Egyptian holdings in nearby Syria and in the Aegean. So these two leaders form a pact, that is Philip of Macedon and Antiochus, and they're going to divide up these Egyptian holdings between them because they've got this young king in Egypt who's inexperienced. It also says that there are some of your own violent ones. So there's a reference there to some Jews, those are the violent ones he's referring to, who joined in this uprising. They felt they were oppressed under Egyptian rule, and that if Antiochus would prevail, they could gain more freedom. So they joined in to support Antiochus. Now, at this time, there was an Egyptian general named Scopas. The Egyptian general Scopas, he squashed this uprising of the Jews, and so there's the comment in verse 14 that they shall fail. So these violent ones sought to join the order, but they shall fail because they were squashed by Scopas. So then this map shows us a little bit of what's going on here. Scopas was successful in many of the battles in Egypt's northern territories. He helped bring the region into subjection to the young Ptolemy V. And then Antiochus defeated him at the Battle of Panium, which is also we would call Caesarea Philippi. So let me magnify part of this map here, and we'll see this area. We're talking about some of this area to the north. So you can see Caesarea Philippi is in the upper middle part of the map near the headwaters of the Jordan River. And at that point, when there was a battle there, Antiochus defeated this Egyptian general Scopas. And that led Scopas to retreat to the north up to Sidon. Well, Sidon is this well-fortified city that's talked about in verse 15. The king of the north shall come and throw up siege works on a well-fortified city. So Antiochus is going to come and lay siege to Sidon because that's where the Egyptian Scopas is hiding out. There were three Egyptian commanders who attempted to liberate Scopas, but they were not successful. And so I think that's what's meant by the end of verse 15, where it talks about the forces of the south shall not stand, nor even his best troops. Some of the best generals were unable to get Scopas out. Eventually, he was forced to surrender to Antiochus in 198 BC. So the surrender of Scopas at Sidon marks a turning point in that area. The Seleucids, who now are going to come and take possession of Palestine, and so it would never again be under the domination of the Ptolemies. And again, I'll magnify this area here. So from Sidon on down, Antiochus is going to take possession of that, and he's going to solidify his control over that area of Phoenicia and also the Holy Land, on down as far as the fortress there in Gaza. We talked about that last night, Gaza and Raphia. So that's that green area that then he reclaimed from Egypt. So again, as we said at the outset, you know, the king of the north and the king of the south, they're throwing land back and forth and back and forth, and Jerusalem's right in the middle. So they're getting trampled on both ways throughout this. Right, yeah. Verse 16 says that he shall do as he wills and no one shall stand before him. So the beautiful land became a possession of Seleucid Empire, or we call the Syrians sometimes. It says he had destruction in his hand, meaning there was destruction associated with the war that came with him. Much of the fighting had been throughout the land of Israel. Antiochus entered Jerusalem in 198 BC. The Jews welcomed him as a deliverer and a benefactor, so he was favorably regarded by them, and they treated him favorably. But he did punish any of the Jews who had been pro-Egyptian. Well, Antiochus was successful in his campaign against Egypt. There were also things happening in the West. Rome is growing in influence and power. They've had numerous battles with Philip of Macedon and others in the region, claiming some of the islands there in the Aegean and some of the territory, Greece and Macedon. So Antiochus was going to come up against Egypt with the strength of his whole kingdom, it says in verse 17, but then he thought better of it. So he decided that he was going to head off the threat of Rome by forming an alliance with Egypt. So he's been battling Egypt. He's recovered land from Egypt. But now he decides he doesn't want a war on two fronts. So he's going to try to smooth things over with Egypt. And once again, how do you do that? Well, what better way than through a marriage? So he attempts to initiate this peace with Egypt by offering his daughter, Cleopatra I, to Ptolemy V in marriage in 193 BC. So she's important because this is when the name Cleopatra gets introduced into Egypt. We mentioned last week that Cleopatra is a Greek name, although we often associate it with Egypt. And this is how it came into the dynasty in Egypt, was through this marriage that Antiochus is arranging. Now remember, Ptolemy is still young at the time. He's maybe now he's 15, 16 years old. We don't know Cleopatra's age for sure. She may have been a few years older, but you know, again, within 5 or 6 years of him in age, probably. So we've got these two young people there. Well, as a dowry, Antiochus offers the revenue of this area here, this Coele Syria, as well as the revenue from other areas, Samaria, Judea, and Phoenicia. So most of this area here, he offered that as the revenue from that area as a dowry. Well, that sounds really extravagant, and it was, but it later became a point of contention because the Egyptians said, you didn't just offer us the revenue, you offered us the territories. So we want those territories. And the Seleucids said, no, it was just the revenue. So that became another point of contention. They never did give up control of the territories, but it was a point of contention with the Egyptians and the Seleucids. So Antiochus hoped that Cleopatra would remain loyal to him. That was one reason he gave her to Ptolemy as a wife, yes, it was going to be a peace treaty, but he also thought, now he's got a spy on the inside, his daughter. He was hoping she'd live up to her name, right? Cleopatra, meaning glory of the father. So he thinks that she's going to be an advocate for the Seleucids and give him control over Egypt. But that's not how things turned out. As it turns out, Cleopatra consistently sides with her husband in any disputes. And so so that didn't work out the way Antiochus thought it would. Now, verse 17 also refers to her as the daughter of women. And the idea here is that she's still young enough that she's under the control and care of her mother and a nurse, and so she's a, in that regard, she's a daughter of women. So Antiochus marries her to Ptolemy with the intent of destroying or gaining control over Egypt, but in the end, it didn't stand, nor did it give him any advantage, as that verse says. Well, then in verse 18, we see there's another turn here. Antiochus the Great now turns his face to the coastlands. So he's been trying to make more progress into Egypt, but now he's going to let things be there for a while. And it says he's going to turn to the coastlands. So he's looking to control some of the islands in the Mediterranean, particularly those up in the Aegean near Greece. At first, he's successful capturing some of the islands, or in some cases, he would form alliances with the Greek city-states. Now, at that time, Rome is also expanding into the region, and they're trying to flex their muscles there. So there's a cold war between Rome and the Seleucids, Antiochus, for about 4 years, from 196 to 192 BC. The Romans saw Greece as their sphere of influence, and Asia Minor was a buffer. The Seleucids saw Asia Minor as the core part of their empire, and they thought Greece was a buffer. So the war between Rome and the Seleucids begins. A league of Greek city-states drew Antiochus into a battle, and the Romans soon joined. Antiochus suffered a defeat at the Battle of Thermopylae. We talked about that a little bit last week. And he then conducted some naval battles in the Aegean. The Roman coalition defeated him in two major battles, and he was forced to retreat. So verse 18 says that a commander will put an end to his ways. There was a Roman commander, Lucius Cornelius Scipio Asiaticus. He actually had a brother with a similar name. His brother's name is more famous and accomplished a lot more. The brother's name was Lucius Cornelius Scipio Africanus. So, Africanus, yeah.
Africanus.
So, this guy, Asiaticus, pursues Antiochus from Greece. He chases him out of Greece. He chases him out of the Aegean Sea and back into Asia Minor. So, Antiochus takes refuge in the city of Antioch. He tries to make some peace negotiations with Rome, but they get broken off because Rome's demands are just crazy. So in 190 BC, Scipio's forces, numbering 30,000, defeated Antiochus' army of 70,000 at the Battle of Magnesia. This is a town that's near Smyrna in modern-day Turkey. It was a humiliating defeat for Antiochus. And previously, Antiochus told the Roman ambassadors, age did not concern them, and he was not subject to their orders. Well, this was the insolence that's referred to in verse 18, and that insolence was heaped back on him through his defeat there at Magnesia. And there's a bust of Cornelius Scipio. Well, then in 188 BC, the Romans forced Antiochus to sign the Treaty of Apamea. And the major terms of the treaty were as follows. He would have to abandon Europe altogether, and he would have to also abandon Asia west of the Taurus Mountains. He had to surrender his war elephants and all but 12 of his warships. He was forced to pay heavy war reparations and also an annual tribute to Rome. And then finally, he had to provide 20 hostages, and Rome was going to select, the Roman consul would select the hostages. And those last two are really important because they're going to have an impact on what follows. So as a result of this, Antiochus would retain some land, but we clearly know who's in charge now. Roman influence, Rome is in charge. And one reason this last point is important is that one of the hostages that was selected by Rome was one of Antiochus the Great's son, and it was Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes, this guy who's going to be the Old Testament Antichrist, okay? He's one of the hostages, and he spends a number of years in Rome. And the war reparations and the tribute are important because they're going to set up another conflict coming up because they're quite excessive. Well, Antiochus was beaten back on every front, so he turned his face to his own fortresses, it says in verse 19. His campaigns for conquest were over. And then his final act came in 187 BC. The tributes from Rome were just stifling. He was trying to raise money to pay the tribute, and so the way he did that was he went and raided a temple in Elymais. This was such an outrage that those who were guarding the temple murdered him. Bible scholar John Walvoord makes the comment that Antiochus the Great could have been one of the great conquerors of the ancient world if he had left Greece alone. But as we've seen, his life was a fulfillment of this prophecy here in Daniel. Well, Antiochus was succeeded by his son, Seleucus IV Philopater. Verse 20 says, he would send an exactor of tribute among the people. And that's what happened. The tribute that Rome demanded out of the Seleucids was 1,000 talents annually, a huge number. In order to raise that money, Seleucus had to go and tax all of the lands that were under his domain. He levied a specially heavy tax on the Jews. Well, he reigned for 12 years and generally regarded as weak or ineffectual. He did arrange for the substitution of one of the Roman hostages, though. He arranged to have one of his sons, Demetrius, go to Rome and for Antiochus Epiphanes to be released. So another important part of the whole picture here that's unraveling before us. So Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes spent 13 years in Rome as that initial hostage because of that Treaty of Apamea. And then before he was substituted out for his brother's son. And there's an image of Seleucus IV. He didn't die in battle. He was poisoned. And that's the reference in verse 20 that he would not die in battle. Well, we'll pause there for now because in verse 21, the attention is going to turn and it's going to focus on the next king, this contemptible person, Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes. And we're going to read about some of the terrible things that he does, but we're also going to see how he is a forerunner or a type of the coming Antichrist and some of the similarities that are born out there. He's an enemy of the Jews in the same way that the Antichrist will be. Okay, so again, a lot of history, a lot coming at you, but let's just kind of do a wrap here then with a couple of questions. Similar to last week, what stands out to you about God? Didn't mention God a lot in here, but God is in here. What stands out to you about him in this passage?
God's in the details.
God's in the details, yeah. Then how about this? We didn't get to this last week, but it's applicable this week too. How do we find strength in God during times of uncertainty and difficulty, like the Jews in Daniel's time were facing?
Trusting in Him.
Well, the uncertainty and difficulty are temporary. God is permanent. Some kind of commentary woven in, like there's judgment coming, so repent, or you're going to be in exile for this amount of time, like Jeremiah, so behave this way. But this is almost bereft of any kind of like, do this, don't do this. You know, it's just almost straight prophecy. And again, this is written before it happened. The time it's happening is in that 400 years of silence, as you mentioned. Prophets are not speaking, but the prophets did speak about the time. I'm just trying to put myself in that situation where you know what's happening, but God is being silent at that time. No temple, just kind of lost, and we're being tossed to and fro by all these other powers. And I wish you would think that. Being prepped for the time of Jesus, they would have been all the more, eager or receptive or anticipating. And some people were, but for the most part, they had gotten used to, I guess, God seeming to be silent or just living as the world. You know what I mean? Like, they're just living how they were. Not many were really looking for Him. The religious leaders were not. They had a whole system built up over 400 years of ignoring God, even though God told them exactly what was going to be happening almost up until the time of Messiah, even all the prophecies. So it's just something about human nature. Right now we're in a period where I don't think God is like speaking, through the prophets, right now too. We have His word. We know He's coming again. Kind of in a similar position as the Jews were in that 400 years time where they know what to do, but are we getting distracted? Are we getting comfortable in the world? Are we not looking for the Messiah, the second coming? It's an interesting parallel in case. I think we're exactly in that time, but we know what's going to happen. We've got to be faithful. We have a mission to serve and honor the Lord, to share the gospel. Just because He's silent doesn't mean He hasn't spoken about what we should do and what He's doing.
Yeah, that's interesting because we talked about in the prophecy before this, the time of the coming of the Messiah was set out pretty clearly. I mean, you could get very close. I mean, maybe you wouldn't know the exact day, but you get very close based upon that vision that was given to Daniel. And so, we would hope that this would be encouragement to see them through, but that they would not have lost sight of that as a goal, and yet they have. Yeah, the synagogues come up in that time. The Pharisees come up in that time, and they took advantage of that time to create a new religion.
Just being concerned about Christianity, we want to hold the faith and not just create a whole other thing. In the meantime,
All right. Any other comments on this week or last week?
I was thinking of that, like if this is a class,
He's in history. He's entwined in all history.
Yeah.
His story.
Yeah.
History.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So. You should tell him that story about if it were in our time.
I may read this. I found a piece that somebody wrote. and trying to help us put this in some context. And it was very clever. He said, imagine that you're a prophet in the year 1700, and you're going to write about this coming kingdom, this coming country. And so he writes about the establishment of America, and he writes about the first six presidents. And I'll read it to you, and you'll know who he's talking about, because you know our history. Right? He talks about a man who will come from a land where there are a lot of volunteers. Well, he's talking about Tennessee, and he's talking about Andrew Jackson, because Jackson came from Tennessee. So he makes references to that, the man from the north and the man from the south and somebody who came from a land that was named after a virgin. So all these things we know because we know our history, but he refers to these people in the same way that this vision here in Daniel is referring to these coming kings in very generic ways. So I'll maybe pull that out and read that next week. That might be kind of an interesting accompaniment to this. Okay, well, let me pray and we can wrap for tonight. Lord, we do thank you that history is your story and that you can be woven throughout the details of what we read tonight and that we can see how they all came true in your time and that you told Daniel and the Jews hundreds of years before that it was coming about. So, Lord, we thank you for that. We thank you that we can see you here. And as we said, Lord, we pray that we might not be complacent either in our time, that we might be looking forward to you, that we might pray regularly that your kingdom would come. So thank you for this time and your word tonight. I pray that you would keep us safely travel home and bless the rest of our week. In Jesus' name.